from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, New York Times Chief White House Correspondent Peter Baker's new book, Days of Fire, provides a detailed look at the defining moments of the George W. Bush administration. His reporting sheds new light on the complex relationship between President Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney, the response to the September 11th attacks, and the decision to invade Iraq. He'll join us in the studio to discuss the book and the significance of the Bush-Cheney partnership. That's coming up on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Peter Baker joins us for this morning's opening Forum Hour, an award-winning journalist. He's chief White House correspondent for the New York Times and covered the White House also for the Washington Post, as well as being a regular panelist on PBS's Washington Week. Author of The Breach, about the impeachment of Bill Clinton, and with his wife Susan Glasser of Kremlin Rising, about Vladimir Putin's Russia, his most recent book is Days of Fire, and it focuses on the years in the White House of President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney, as well as their relationship, which Peter Baker characterizes as the most collaborative White House relationship since Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. He joins us in studio for this opening hour, and good to have you here. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, this is an enigmatic relationship, and let's begin by sort of deconstructing it to what extent we can, although there's probably more that we don't know than that we know. But the fact of the matter is that what we do know, at least from your book, is that all jokes notwithstanding about President Cheney and all that, Bush was much more of a central figure than most people realize in terms of who had the power, who was making the decisions, being the decider.
Right. Here's a surprise, right? George Bush ran his own White House. And it's and it is a little bit of a surprise, I think, because we've bought a lot into this cartoonish version of what that White House was all about. We all know the jokes, the SNL skits, you know, Cheney's the secret power behind the throne, the puppet master. And the truth is it was much more complicated than that. Was Cheney a very powerful figure? Yes. Was he the most influential vice president to date? Certainly. But in fact, the relationship was more complicated than that. Bush leaned on him at the beginning, but increasingly began moving away from him as the presidency wore on, as he began looking for ways of righting the ship with Iraq going badly. And so it's actually a much more complicated story than I think, and a much more interesting story than I think that many of us understood.
Well, by the second term, with Rumsfeld gone and Condoleezza Rice wielding a great deal more power, and the hunting accident and five heart attacks, things went in a very different direction. But let's talk about the invasion of Iraq, because certainly in that way, Cheney was a major player.
No question about that. And he pushed President Bush from the beginning after 9/11 to think about Iraq. In fact, at one of their private lunches, he says, "Are you going to take care of this guy or not?" And it kind of, yeah, that's a pretty goading thing to say to a president. But the other thing to remember is, and he managed to outmaneuver his rivals internally, like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell in particular. He understood how power worked in Washington in a way that a lot of people did not, especially George W. Bush, who came from a governorship in Texas. But the other thing that's important to remember is that I think he was pushing on open doors. I think people sometimes think, oh, he pushed Bush into going to war. And I don't think that's the case. I think he definitely pushed it. He definitely was urging him in that direction. But he found a president who was willing and interested and inclined to go in that direction. And when, in fact, even in the early days when Bush didn't want to go where Cheney led, he turned him down. Cheney wanted to first attack Iraq in the summer of 2002 when they found a camp for Zarqawi, who later became such a problem for American troops in northern Iraq. And Bush said, no, we're not going to do that yet. I want to try this diplomacy route. Cheney didn't want him to go to the U.N., Bush went to the UN anyway. So I think it's too simple to suggest that Cheney took him into war. I think Bush was a fool and in fact, the dominant partner in that regard.
Well, in that regard, your colleague Maureen Dowd, for example, used to make the case about a severe Oedipus complex on the part of George W. Bush trying to right the wrongs that he felt needed to be righted where his father was concerned, and that was really behind or the Iraq invasion perhaps more than anything else. But what we get from your book is a much more balanced view of that. And also, I think, not to diss Maureen, but also...
Never.
nor too well. But there's also a sense of you know, Cheney being this almost stereotypical figure of Darth Vader and the paranoid character. I mean, particularly after 9/11, he was down in his hole, and he liked that image, too.
He ended up sort of embracing the dark reputation that he had. I mean, it's interesting. Bush bristled at this idea that Cheney was really running things. And in fact, by the end of this first term, Cheney offers to drop off the ticket, and Bush thinks about it, and he says the reason he thinks about it is to show who's really in charge, which suggests how sensitive he's become.
He was actually thinking of Bill Frist.
He was thinking about, exactly, Bill Frist, the senator from Tennessee, would have been his choice as a replacement, which we didn't know until after leaving office. Cheney, by contrast, has sort of a dry kind of sense of humor and eventually kind of embraces this. His staff buys a Darth Vader costume, and he puts the mask on and poses for a picture, which unfortunately we still haven't seen. It's somewhere in the National Archives. It was has yet to ever been released. He tried to put it in his memoir, and Lynn Cheney, his wife, talked him out of it.
Well, the whole question of leadership, though, I mean, you think about the role of people like Rumsfeld and L. Paul Bremer in that administration, for that matter, General Casey and other generals, or Harry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury after the crash, and they were really quite significant. So when we look at the administration, we're looking at Bush and Cheney in large part, but some other pretty, shall we say, salient figures in terms of the power.
A lot of them. Very fascinating figures, all of whom play important and critical roles at various moments. You mentioned the ones you said, Hank Paulson and Don Rumsfeld and others. There's also, as you also mentioned, Condoleezza Rice, David Petraeus, Colin Powell. And it's Bush took this MBA idea into the presidency of being a delegator rather than an in-the-weeds kind of manager. He believed that you found people that you trusted, you invested them with authority, you made the big decisions. He was the decider, as he said. But he didn't believe in mucking around in those details himself. And it took him years, in fact, to finally reject this deferential treatment, approach he takes to the generals to begin actually getting involved in the Iraq War in a more assertive individual way.
Peter Baker is our guest, and his new book is called Days of Fire. The subtitle is Bush and Cheney in the White House, and I should mention he'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, and you can actually meet Peter Baker, who is White House correspondent, chief White House correspondent for the New York Times. So let's move from this partnership to a major breach in it. It came over Scooter Libby, and it came over the granting of what at least was wanted by Dick Cheney, a pardon to Scooter Libby, who felt that he'd been wounded on the field of battle and felt that President Bush was leaving a good man wounded on the field of battle. And to a great extent, there was a good deal of hemorrhaging and real indignation over that, over Bush not going along with it. I couldn't help, in reading about it, wondering, though, if maybe Bush was also thinking about Clinton's late pardons and how that cast a shadow over his presidency.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Bush was always scornful of the pardon process, didn't much like it. He had seen what happened with Clinton, where he gave Mark Rich and other controversial figures last-minute pardons as he leaves the office. His father had gotten some blowback for giving some Iran-Contra pardons as he left office at the end of his term. And so, in fact, George W. Bush had been most conservative, I guess, on pardons of any president other than his father in the last century. He gave out the fewest of any president, even over 8 years. He believed it was sort of like a process kind of corrupted in some ways by people who had special access. And so here comes Dick Cheney, the person with the most special access of anyone, making a special pleading for somebody close to him. And it rankled against what Bush believed about pardons. And he said no. He sent the lawyers out to reexamine the case. Lawyers come back and say, look, we looked at it. We went and met with Scooter Libby again at a seafood restaurant. We think the jury had every reason to find what it found.
So when they were going through the transition between the Bush administration and the Obama administration, President Bush's advice to President Obama was, if you're going to pardon, pardon early?
Yeah, no, it wasn't quite that. But it was interesting. He was thinking about this even on the last day, right? So Inauguration Day comes, 2009. President-elect Obama shows up at the White House for the traditional coffee. La, 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 you know, a lot of formalities. They get in the car together, just the two of them, President Bush and President-elect Obama, to head to the Capitol, literally the last few minutes of the Bush presidency. And the piece of advice he gives President Obama is set a pardon policy early and stick to it. Don't let anybody try to talk you out of it. So it's interesting that even these final minutes of his presidency, what's on his mind is this rift with his vice president and the final act of their extraordinary and tumultuous 8-year partnership.
I don't know if it's a result of Obamacare or, other things that have been heralded as the failures of this administration by those opposed to it. But Bush's popularity seems to be up, according to recent polls. I mean, there may be some revisionism going on even, or nostalgia. I don't know.
A little bit. You know, look, we tend to think more highly of our former presidents than we do that when they're in office. We're more generous with them. The passions of the moment cool a little bit. I do think that conservatives who were disaffected with President Bush have now come back to him because they dislike President Obama more. And I think that some liberals and some moderates are a little more remember him a little bit more fondly because he's not a Tea Party Republican, right? He's for immigration reform. He was for expanding Medicare to cover prescription medicines. He was in their view, a more reasonable figure by comparison to some of today's Republicans. That all may be nostalgia and romanticizing and so forth. And it's important to remember many, many, many Americans still don't feel that way, obviously. But he is at 49% favorable in the most recent poll versus 46% unfavorable, which for him is the first positive balance in 8 years.
Not necessarily conservative about support of the Tea Party, however.
No, well, yeah, the Tea Party in a way is a rebellion as much against George W. Bush as it is Barack Obama. I mean, it grows out of his presidency. Bush was never a small government conservative. He was a big government conservative. He believed in an assertive federal role in education through No Child Left Behind. He spent more money and he did build up some deficits that aggravated conservatives and the people who would later become the Tea Party. And his foreign policy, a very interventionist foreign policy, is anathema to a lot of the more libertarian Tea Party types who are concerned about us being too active in the world and don't like what they see as the surveillance state that he left behind.
Well, he started off saying there would be no nation building, and then
right.
Iraq was, which really overshadowed so much, as you point out, of his administration, along with, we had David Finkel on yesterday talking about the surge and that whole sense of regret that Bush had comes into play in your narrative, as well as, of course, talking about shadows of his administration, what happened in terms of the American economy. But I'm also struck by the fact that Bush really found it very difficult to apologize or to admit that he was wrong. And yet what comes across in your work is real second thoughts about Iraq and about particularly about maybe not doing a surge earlier or putting more troops in earlier.
Yeah, I think he believed that he looked at what LBJ did and he took lessons from that. And the two lessons he took from that are, one, don't micromanage a war, and two, don't show public doubt. Okay. And he learned those lessons to such a degree that perhaps, as we often do, we overlearn lessons. He was so deferential to the generals and so inactive in making specific decisions in terms of strategy. That took 3 years from the invasion to 2006 when he finally says, this is going wrong, I have to step in, and the surge is his answer. And by the same token, this notion of not showing doubt, not giving any hint of second thoughts or doubts in public was his belief that doing so undermined the troops, undermined the war effort, and encouraged enemies. But in fact, in private, like anybody, he entertained doubts and second guessing of strategy, at least, even if not the fundamental decision to go in.
So that was a facade.
Well, as every president does, you have a public face, right? And you have private anxieties. I'm looking forward to the days we read the Obama books and learn about what he's thinking at this moment about his health care program. But I think there's his aides found President Bush much more upset and concerned about what was going on in Iraq than he publicly showed. So one aide told me that he seemed almost despondent in meetings. He said it was, quote, like he wants us to not tell him any more bad news. He was grinding his teeth so much his mouth hurt, his jaw hurt. When they finally killed Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, and the aides come to tell him, he doesn't react in any kind of positive way. And they say, well, what's wrong? He says, I just don't even know how to react to good news anymore because there have been so little of it.
I remember an interview I did a number of years ago with Newt Gingrich, and he was talking about how smart Bush was, you know, which is, again, not the image that people have of him.
Yeah.
It seems counterintuitive, but he said it's not the kind of intelligence like book intelligence or intellect or anything like that. He said, in fact, he's the kind of guy who likes to play video games and that sort of thing. He said, but he's much brighter, especially in political intelligence and a kind of pragmatic intelligence that one needs in the political sphere. And yet it was Cheney, as you point out, who really understood the way the ropes were pulled and the way Congress was run and everything. But he did have a kind of internal savvy that was really quite smart.
I think we again we underestimated or misunderestimated President Bush, partly because he wasn't very good at articulating himself all the time. Right, he said things in public that contributed to this notion that he wasn't a bright guy. Like, is our children learning?
Fool me once.
Right, the whole thing. There are many examples. In fact, Jacob Weisberg has a great book of Bushisms, as he put it. But those are articulation problems, not intellectual problems. He's not an intellect as Newt Gingrich is, as Bill Clinton is, but he is a very bright guy who goes to Andover, Yale, Harvard. And I think what happens is he himself encourages this notion of not being very bright because he plays to this anti-intellectual image, right?
He even developed a Texas accent, unlike his brother Jed.
Well, he actually did. I mean, he's legitimately a Texan, but he hated the Eastern elitism he saw when he went to Yale. He bristled against it. And so he, through life, he kind of like mocked that way of thinking. And I think he liked to lower expectations. He specifically said to people, I like it when people think, hey, that SOB can't even put together a sentence. But at a certain point, and he made jokes about being a C student and so on. But at a certain point, people started to believe him. And I think that kind of undercut his you know, public reputation.
What about his religiosity, which was part of that public reputation? I mean, I remember in the first debate, he was asked the most important philosopher, and he said Jesus, and he was always kind of intimating that maybe there was some kind of pipeline he had talking to God. It was certainly not a secular-minded administration, you know, from any perspective. And I know Laura Bush, who was a Methodist, had a lot of influence on him in terms of religiosity. But how religious really was he?
Well, I think he's deeply religious. I think his religion helped him conquer his biggest lifetime failing, which is the drinking. He perpetuated till he was age 40. It informed his understanding of the world. His cousin John Ellis once said that he always laughed when people said that George Bush was courting the religious right because he is the religious right. And I think there is something to that. Having said that, it's not a kind of vision of intolerance that sometimes is perpetuated by some people in the community. In fact, he hated the notion of gay bashing. He hated being perceived as lecturing. And so he struggled, I think, to balance his own personal faith with and courting people, you know, in the religious community with being seen as a figure that had been stereotypically alienating to many other Americans.
Well, part of his whole stance on immigration was his feeling a connection to the Hispanic community. I mean, a lot of that was political pragmatism, admittedly, but he really did feel those connections in Texas. And I was struck by something he said about Katrina being his greatest regret, that he was pictured somehow as a bigot and all of those sorts
of
things.
That. Yeah, yeah. I think Bush was Bush's initial conception of his presidency was compassionate conservatism. He wanted to move the Republican Party actually away from Gingrich-style, bombastic-style politics rather than get rid of the education department, which is what a lot of conservatives wanted to do. He wanted to empower it and give more money to education as long as it came with testing and so on and so forth. So the compassionate conservatism, of course, gets subsumed by 9/11 in Iraq. And it kind of, as Karen Hughes says, she laments the fact that that sort of gets lost in the end. And you don't see much of it in today's political environment.
What about the tax cuts? I mean, you know, certainly if one looks at Bush's, it's early to talk about legacy. And that's, again, part of his conservatism. He really wanted – he also wanted, of course, to make Social Security, essentially to privatize it. And that never went through. But he certainly got the tax cuts through, and it had an enormous effect.
He did have to get the tax cuts through. His view of it when he took over was there were surpluses. There were $5 trillion in projected surpluses over 10 years, and he wanted to give a third of it back in tax cuts. A lot of it obviously went to the wealthy. A lot of it also went to the poor, and that gets overlooked. Millions of people were taken off the tax rolls as a result of those tax cuts. In the end, President Obama has managed to preserve those tax cuts, actually, for the vast majority of Americans, with the exception of the very wealthiest. So it's interesting that they have now become part of the permanent landscape.
He's also managed to preserve Guantanamo and a number of other things from this administration.
Well, President Obama, in effect, has validated some of President Bush's presidency by preserving and continuing a lot of things. There's more continuity than people think between presidents, even of different parties.
More drones, too.
More drones.
We're talking to Peter Baker, who is the author of Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House, and is chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club at noon today in San Francisco. And in the meantime, we invite you to join this conversation when you assess the Bush-Cheney presidency? That is, it really was Bush as president and Cheney as vice president. What comes to your mind, and what do you think is perhaps the biggest success, the biggest failure, and what about the details of that administration? What perhaps looms in your mind as some of the biggest questions, particularly vis-a-vis the relationship between Bush and Cheney as a partnership, as a kind of enigmatic marriage in many ways, because as Peter Baker points out in his book, you often don't know what goes on after everybody else leaves a room and Dick Cheney is quiet and then the two of them are alone. We welcome your calls and we invite you to join us. Our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. If you'd like to join the program and join the conversation, please feel free to do that now. Again, it's 866-733-6786 for your calls, for your emails. The email address is forum@kqed.org. And you can also post any questions or comments or join the conversation by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, obviously a number of ways to communicate with us. What about the role of the architect in that administration? I mean, Karl Rove is often given maybe even more of a role sometimes and an authoritative stance and props than Cheney.
Yeah. No, he was obviously a central figure, a signature figure. But he lost the most interesting fight during the 2000 campaign that he, in fact, orchestrated, the fight whether or not to put Cheney on the ticket. He was against Cheney as a vice presidential pick, which I think would be surprising to a lot of people. And in fact, Bush says to him, fine, come down to the governor's mansion, make your case about why we shouldn't have Cheney on the ticket. Carl shows up along with a couple other aides, walks in. The president says, okay, tell me your case. And there sitting in the room was Dick Cheney. So Rove has to go forward and give his case for why Cheney shouldn't be on the ticket with Cheney sitting right there, recognizing he might be about to become the second most powerful man in America.
Cheney didn't Cheney also bring Danforth into the whole
Danforth,
equation about
John
a possible
Danforth,
vice presidential
yeah,
run?
He was the senator from Missouri, and he was basically the runner-up. He was the one that Bush liked the most other than Cheney. They had an interview with him, in fact, even after he'd already offered it or basically picked Cheney. And they used Danforth at one point to kind of shield the public disclosure that they had picked Cheney, kind of leaked out. Carl specifically, Rove specifically leaked out that Danforth was a choice in order to throw reporters off the trail.
I learned from your book, there's a lot to learn from your book, but something I never knew, and that is that Bush wanted his father to drop Dan Quayle. I always thought of Quayle as kind of a surrogate George W. Bush. They were both deeks. They both kind of had a similar way of expressing themselves,
right.
Problems articulating, those kinds of things.
Familiarity breeds contempt. I don't know. He did think that Quayle was a liability to the ticket in 1992, and the person he suggested be put on the ticket was actually Dick Cheney, the defense secretary at the time. Didn't happen, obviously. His dad didn't do it. But as he later joked, he said, you know, I guess I always had this idea of a Bush-Cheney ticket on my mind.
Well, and it is a fascinating, again, for lack of a better word to describe it, there are wanting signifiers here, but partnership, and maybe even more a marriage in some ways than a partnership. We're going to take a quick break here, as we normally do at this juncture, and then when we come back, we're going to hear from you and your thoughts. We're talking with New York Times Chief White House Correspondent Peter Baker. His new book is Days of Fire, and it provides a detailed look at the defining moments of the George W. Bush administration, and his reporting sheds new light on not only that complex relationship between President Bush and Vice President Cheney, but also the response to the 9/11 attacks, the decision to invade Iraq, and we'll continue talking with him and with you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this opening hour with Peter Baker, author of Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House, and chief White House correspondent for The New York Times. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club today at noon, and we're talking about the Bush-Cheney administration. Let's get your calls in here, and let's go first to Mike. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Yes. I was just wondering, Cheney supposedly lost favor in the second term, and I was wondering how closely that was connected with the perception that Rumsfeld had failed as Secretary of Defense, because they both came in pretty much at the same time from the same previous administration.
It's a good question, because Rumsfeld was sort of Cheney's mentor in many ways, wasn't he?
He really was. They were very close, been close for 40 years. Rumsfeld gave Cheney his first White House job in the Nixon White House, made him his deputy when he was chief of staff in the Ford White House, and so on. And they're so close, they have vacation homes next to each other in Maryland. They vacationed and overseas together. So, yeah, Cheney and was Rumsfeld's protector. Probably helped keep Rumsfeld in that job a couple extra years than he might have otherwise been. People were coming to President Bush at the end of 2004 and saying, it's time, you know, this is a good opportunity for you to change horses here at defense. And he wouldn't do it, at least in part, because Cheney was advocating for him. And I think, as the caller says, as Mike says, I think that, you know, as Iraq went bad, Bush was looking for new paths forward. He was looking for new answers. And that's where he and Cheney begin to diverge. But Bush looks more toward diplomacy with Iran and North Korea, Syria. He empowers Condoleezza Rice to become as Secretary of State. She begins trying to negotiate Middle East peace talks, repair the breach, if you will, with the European allies. And he also begins to compromise some of the terrorism programs, detention, interrogation, Guantanamo. And Cheney thinks all this is a betrayal of the principles that they had shared at the beginning and moving in the wrong direction.
Well, as you point out, in fact, Cheney sort of used the Obama administration kind of a whipping boy for some of that when they came into power, because they wanted re-examine torture, and they did, in fact, re-examine torture.
Yeah.
and looked at the CIA and what they had been doing and so forth. Just getting back to the caller, though, Rumsfeld also went on the cheap in Iraq. I mean, you know, in terms of boots on the ground and all that. And to some extent, Bush was being guided by that, and maybe the caller is right. Maybe he felt a good deal of animus to Rumsfeld because Rumsfeld wanted to save money and he didn't.
Well, I think he became jaded about to some extent about Rumsfeld. But he also believed that Rumsfeld was taking arrows that were in fact meant for him, that is Bush. So it was a complicated, you know, dynamic there. At one point during Abu Ghraib, Rumsfeld comes and offers his resignation and then leaves. And President Bush turns to an aide and says, well, that's a pretty clever move by the crusty old guy. He called my bluff, meaning he thought that it was not a genuine offer to resign, but a political tack to kind of box the president in. So he was pretty jaded, I think, about Rumsfeld to some extent by the time that he left office.
And we're talking to Peter Baker, and our next caller joins us from Lexington, Tennessee. Dan, you're on. Hi.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, I don't want to oversimplify this, but it seems to me, I mean, I've been around for a while. I'm 61 years old, and I've constantly heard this praise for presidents after they leave office. They become, you know, very intellectual. We hear about their private, quiet moments and the decision-making and so on. It seems like they're talking about George Bush being a very bright person.
And, Dan, don't forget the library dedications.
Okay. Where are these people, though, to talk about these presidents while they're in office? Because it seems as though we are such a nation divided, and there are people who are just adamantly opposed because of such extreme partisanship in this country, and people are just adamantly opposed to a president if he's not their guy. And I wonder why we don't have more people talking about presidents during their current term in such glowing fashion as we do right now. Because, you know, I agree with this. I don't think that any of this is untrue. But, you know, I lost a little favor with George Bush, you know, in the second term, and what happened with the recession and, you know, the droning on of war and things of this nature, and what happened to the economy. So are we going to be speaking about Barack Obama like this? Because I know we did with Lyndon Johnson, and, you know, past presidents seem to really be a lot better than what they were than when they were in office. So.
That's a great point. I think that you're absolutely right. We grow fonder of the president we no longer have than the president we do have. And that's true of a lot of them. Truman is the ultimate example. Bush really hopes for a Truman-like experience. Truman left office bitterly unpopular with the public. The Korean War had gone so badly. There is a parallel there to Iraq in that sense. And yet today we view him with sort of a certain veneration for sort of creating the architecture of a new national security structure that went through the Cold War. Most presidents haven't gone through quite that extreme of from low to high. But we do. We have revisionist thinking about Eisenhower lately. Been 4 or 5 books on him lately. Been very interesting. You know, we have to be careful to leaven those sort of post facto hindsight analysis with memories of what it was like in the day, because what it was like in the Bush day was pretty polarized, as you say, just as it is today with President Obama.
And we thank you, Dan, for that call. I'm looking at some web comments here. A listener writes, talking about previous presidents, many people forget that Dick Cheney came out of the Nixon administration. This says a lot about his inside-the-beltway politics and skillful behind-the-scenes political maneuvering. Even more amazing to me is that Democrats campaigning for Gore and Kerry never brought this up in any meaningful way.
Yes. Well, he was in the Nixon White House. He was a very junior guy in the Nixon White House and wasn't involved in the things that obviously brought down Nixon. But I think he learned his political infighting and power politics a little bit more in the Ford White House, where he was deputy chief of staff and chief of staff. He helps get Nelson Rockefeller replaced on the ticket in 1976. He's quarreling with Henry Kissinger over detente. It's really in that experience that he begins to sort of come more to the fore.
Al writes an email. He says, has the author included any mention of the story that Cheney, Rumsfeld, and others in his crowd tried to convince administrations, beginning with Reagan, to attack Iraq? They supposedly refused until Bush? That's news to me.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not familiar with that particular thing. I found, though, in the research of this book, an oral history that Dick Cheney gave in 2000. He gave it just months before becoming vice presidential candidate, and it was sealed until after they left office. So it only came public about a year or so ago. And he was asked about Iraq, and did they make a mistake in not going all the way to Baghdad in 1991 when they liberated Kuwait? And he defended the decision back then. He said, no, we shouldn't have gone to Baghdad. We would have owned the country. It would have been a mess. There would have been sectarian strife, and it would have been a quagmire. So even in 2000, just literally months before becoming vice president, he was of the mind that going into Iraq in a full-on way was a mistake. And that changes, obviously, within a year or so when 9/11 happens.
Talking to Peter Baker, and once again, his new book is called Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. He is chief White House correspondent for The New York Times, and you can join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. We'll go to Van in Livermore next. Van, you're on.
Hello. I'm curious about Peter Baker's perspective on Bush's tolerance or even welcoming of varied opinions amongst his legal advisors, especially on foreign policy. You know, did he have, you know, any sense of team of rivals, you know, similar to Lincoln, or did he pretty much live in a bubble, as it were? And I'll take my comments off here.
Okay. Well, he listened to him on the Libby pardon question.
He did. You know, he did have – there was a team of rivals, right? In the first term, you had Colin Powell and, to some extent, Condi Rice versus – Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. I think Bush didn't like the conflict. He didn't mind having contrary opinions. He actually, I think, you know, did welcome them. But the conflicts that grew in his administration became very personal, very bitter. At one point, Condoleezza Rice is walking through the colonnade of the White House with Don Rumsfeld saying, well, where did this all go wrong? Why are we having so much conflict? And he says, look, I don't know. I mean, I always thought you were bright enough. And she takes that wrong. She says to herself, she thinks bright enough is condescending, and it only furthers, you know, this sort of very personal as well as ideological divides that were, you know, dividing the Bush White House. So, you know, it's not quite a team of rivals. And a team of rivals is, again, a romanticized version, right, of a past president's administration.
And she, you also quote her essentially as saying if Cheney would have continued, there would have been more China broken.
Right. Her view was the second term changes because they had, as she said, broken China in the first term, which she felt that they had to do.
We're not talking about the nation here.
Not China the nation, but China the dishware. And then that's a metaphor, obviously. But after 9/11, her view was the country was so vulnerable they had to do things, even if they stepped on toes, made trade-offs they otherwise wouldn't have liked to have made, done things in secret. And by the second term, things had become a little calmer and stabler. It was time to begin to rebuild some of the relationships and repair the damage. But as she said, the vice president would have liked to continue breaking China.
And go to some of your emails here. Frank writes, could you take some time and drill down on the Iraq war decision? What conclusion does the author reach regarding Bush's war decision? What were Bush's underlying motives? And how was Bush able to get Powell to give the United Nations speech? Does Bush have any regrets about destroying Powell?
Yeah, that's a good question. Look, I think, you know, as you say, Maureen Dowd wrote about whether the fathers – failure to finish off the job had part of it. I think,
or whether Saddam trying to kill the father.
Or Saddam, and he mentions that in private, both in private actually and once or twice in public. He says, you know, this guy tried to kill my daddy. There's no question that personal animosity and feelings play a role in anybody's decision making. But I think that he was genuinely convinced about the intelligence that turned out to be wrong about weapons. I think he genuinely believed that Saddam Hussein had these weapons and was a threat. They came in with the idea that Iraq was a threat. So after 9/11, where they're imagining a world filled with danger, Iraq seems even more dangerous, even if it's not involved with 9/11. And remember what happens in those months after 9/11 is not just the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. It's the anthrax attacks, which at the time they didn't know where it came from. There was a scare at the White House about a botulinum. They thought they had been exposed to botulinum. There are these Pakistani nuclear scientists who've been meeting with Osama bin Laden every day. Bush and Cheney get this threat matrix telling them all the different ways that it looked like bad guys in the world were trying to kill Americans. Some of them real, some of them fanciful, but it creates an environment in which you take measures that might seem extreme in another context.
Seems like a long time ago to memory, but we were getting green lights and red lights and yellow lights, you know, in terms of the dangers that were supposedly bubbling up in one form or another.
Right.
But there was a senior administration official that you spoke to who said we really had to go into Iraq because Afghanistan wasn't a tough enough fill in your vulgar word for the behind
right.
kick to kick.
We need to kick somebody's posterior. And what I think he means by that, this is an official who's not on the record but is quoted in the book anonymously and deeply involved in the Iraq stuff, and he regrets it today. And I think his point is not just the White House, but the country even as a whole felt this fear, this appetite for action. Afghanistan seemed to happen very quickly. We didn't really realize what a quagmire it would become. And there was this desire, in his view, both in the White House and the country at large, to do something to go and make the world safer, in effect. And Iraq was just there waiting to be hit.
It's called American payback, I guess, on some
level.
Well,
you know.
Or let me get another caller on here who wants to talk about the Iraq War. Robin, go ahead.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Peter. You know, when Bush did go into Iraq and, you know, that language that he used, you know, he tried to kill my daddy, you know, and then goes and plays golf in Texas. I mean, I just don't think that is what, you know, a president should do. You know, I mean, I just don't think he knew that he threw a rock into a hornet's nest and walked away. And I just think we're still there. It's still a mess. And I just have no respect for Bush at all.
Do you have respect for? I just have to ask you, Robin. President Obama plays a lot of golf too, and there are a lot of drones that are going out there. It's not like a full scale war like it was in Iraq, but I think he plays as much, maybe even more golf than President Bush. Eisenhower probably played the most golf, actually.
Yeah, in office, that's for sure. Actually, the truth is President Bush stopped playing golf in office because, in fact, he was worried about exactly this perception. He was worried about sending this message in the middle of a war to the troops that he was simply off enjoying himself. And so, in fact, from 2003 on, he never played golf again in office. I think he might have hit a putt or two up at Camp David. After office, he's begun playing golf quite a lot, absolutely. And
going to a lot of high school football games.
He's gone to football games, and he is enjoying his retirement. He's also, though, working with wounded veterans, and he cared, I think, a great deal about people who went over there, like David Finkel wrote about in his book, who came back scarred and are trying to rebuild their lives.
Listener named Stephen writes, I was wondering, did or does President Bush fully understand the extent of the suffering that the Iraq War caused both our many soldiers who served there as well as the Iraqi people themselves? And has he ever publicly apologized or expressed regret?
No, he hasn't publicly apologized or expressed regret for the decision to go in. He has, I think, expressed regrets for some of the decisions about how it was handled, that he would have they should have had more troops. They should have done better at the quote post-war planning. But yeah, you know, does he understand the suffering? I mean, that's, you know, a good question. He obviously is not an Iraqi and has spent a very limited time there. He did spend a lot of time meeting with the families of soldiers who were lost. I think he met with something like 900 relatives or more of people who were killed or wounded in Iraq. And he took those very personally. They were private things without reporters, without cameras, usually just one aide. And I talked to some of the relatives who met with him, and they said he would be would hug them, and he would sob. And it's funny because he's a very emotive guy, a little like Bill Clinton in that regard. But he separated them somehow from the policy. The fact that he saw this tragedy up close and he felt it very personally didn't change his view about the war and make him decide we have to get out. In fact, if anything, it was the opposite, because some of these families would tell him, don't make it for nothing. Don't make my son have died for nothing. And he kind of interpreted those things in a different direction of policy.
Stephen writes, I wonder, does Mr. Baker know why Bush and Cheney refused to be interviewed separately during the 9/11 investigation, insisting that they would only talk together in the same room?
Yeah, that's a good question. A very interesting moment. They did talk together. And in fact, at the time, the perception was, or the thinking by some of the commissioners was, aha, this is a way of protecting Bush, because that way Cheney will be there and do all the real talking, and Bush won't be exposed for not really knowing things. It actually turned out to be the opposite. And I talked to people who were in the room. Bush did almost all of the talking. Cheney did very little talking. And Bush was in full command of the facts and the information that he was presenting, at least at that time.
Still that appearance, though, that Cheney's somehow the ventriloquist has to be there.
Right. But in fact, some of the commissioners came to the opposite conclusion, that rather than an attempt to protect Bush, it was actually an attempt to protect Cheney, so that Cheney never had to answer questions in a separate venue.
Here's a caller from Colorado Springs. Dina, go ahead. You're on the air with us. Welcome.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, as a former moderate Republican who's now a registered independent and would love to see Colin Powell run, although I recognize that's probably not going to happen, can you provide some insight into the Bush and Colin Powell relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you mentioned earlier his UN presentation. I forgot to come back at. I think Bush was kind of wary of Powell. Powell was the one figure in the country who was by far more popular than he was. And he had an independent stature and credibility that didn't owe itself to George Bush. And so he decided to have him inside the tent, in effect, by making him Secretary of State, try to associate himself with Powell's popularity and credibility. But the day Powell was announced, Powell gives this bravura performance at the announcement, this tour of the world, in effect, and Bush's aides kind of look at themselves thinking, oh gosh, we're going to have to worry about this guy. We have to control this guy. And one aide put it to me that Bush kind of looked at Powell kind of like the older brother star quarterback who always kind of, you know, you're never quite able to match. And so there was kind of this kind of unease in their relationship. They never fully connected.
Powell and Cheney were actually pretty tight for a while,
well,
weren't they?
They had been partners, yeah, in effect, during the Gulf War, right? We all remember the Gulf War press conferences. Powell in uniform as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Cheney as the defense secretary, briefing us on what was happening. But even then, there were signs of future friction. And, you know, when Cheney left office, he didn't stop by to say goodbye to General Powell. And Powell, I think, actually found that a little hurtful. And he had even at the time joked about Cheney being a right-wing ideologue. And so when he comes into the administration, the new administration—
joking about something that's real?
Well, you know, I mean, some people thought that Cheney was a moderate who became a conservative. I think he was always conservative, but simply served moderate presidents, and therefore we misunderstood him.
We asked on Twitter what listeners thought the Bush and Cheney greatest successes and failures were. Just to give you some tweets here, Peter writes, leadership without emotional intelligence. Bush, Cheney, Rice, Rumsfeld, utterly unreflective and ego-driven as a group. BT writes, failure, encouraging subprime housing loans, and too many others to name in 140 characters. I'm getting a lot of that kind of...
Yeah, 140 characters is never enough. Well, for any legacy, good or bad.
But negative responses about President Bush particularly. Let me just read some of these. Laura writes, and these are emails, your guest argues that President Bush is an intelligent person because after all he went to Yale and Harvard. Does he really think that Bush had a chance entering either of these universities if he weren't a grandson of a senator, son of a CIA director, VP president? Another listener writes on our website, Dumbya, D-U-M-B-Y-A, was a relative dummy in the Bush family and among other politicians and was largely told or tricked by others as to what to do. The invasion of Iraq was at least in part due to Dumbya's wanting to upstage his father to prove his father that he was worthy. And Debbie writes on our website, I refer your guests to several books by Molly Ivins and Jim Hightower, two Texans who knew the real Bush, not the Potemkin Bush. From what I learned from these two authors, Bush is nothing like the person your guest is saying he is. Well, you're trying to give a nuanced presentation of the president here, and I recognize with people still having strong feelings, it's difficult and challenging. But let me read another from the other side of the continuum. John writes, following the events of September 11, 2001, I saw the president in an entirely new light. I felt him for the first time as sympathetic and available, and there seemed to be this great revenge swelling toward the Iraq war invasion. Can you say more about the shift in the presidency around this period?
Yeah, look, you know, all of those are you know, legitimate and commonly held views, I think, in the public today. He is a controversial figure, a polarizing figure, and he will continue to be. When we say he's doing better in the polls, we still are talking about a 49-46 split. That means that's a pretty polarized view of this president. And I think that will always, or at least certainly, be the case for a number of years to come. On Iraq, I think, you know, I think he saw Iraq after it began to go badly. He would never think of it as a mistake, but as something that was consuming his administration. And it did. He wanted to do a number of things in his second term, like change Social Security, change immigration, change the tax code, all of which get sidelined because of Iraq. And so, in fact, his decision to send more troops in 2006 becomes his way of redeeming the last 3 years as the war has gone so badly. And he tries in a desperate way to salvage something out of it and turn things around, which at least does turn around before he leaves office.
There are many who argue that, for better or worse, what happened during particularly Obama's first administration, little did we know that it would also carry into this, is affordable health care, that has dominated.
Yeah.
And certainly one can say the same about the Iraq war with respect to Bush and Cheney. I think, in effect, you do say that. And remember that duck hunting incident? I think Marie-Louis wants to bring it up here. No, go ahead, Marie-Louis.
Well, yes, that I would like to hear the author's opinion of that time when Cheney was duck hunting, which I thought an act couldn't be in poorer taste than he going off to do this while he had a lot to do with that young men and women had gone off to Iraq. And people were dying there, both Americans and Iraqi people.
You make a very good point, Marie-Louis, but he's also made a joke after that, too. I mean, that certainly didn't help his credibility, did it, Peter?
Well, there are a number of things that happened with that. Of course, the accident hitting his friend made him a punchline of 1,000 late-night television shows. But it also drove a little bit more of a wedge between him and President Bush. The way he handled it, he didn't make it public right away. And when he did, he didn't come out personally to explain or apologize until 4 days later when the president kind of nudged him out there. Even Laura Bush from Europe, when she first heard about it from her Secret Service detail, was upset that this hadn't been made public and intervened to try to get the vice president to let the press know what's happened. And it was part of the evolution of their relationship, one more step along the path toward a distance that they had.
I suppose it was more, and I think you intimate this as well, a professional than a personal relationship.
I did interview Vice President Cheney as well as 275 other folks who were involved in the administration. And Cheney says, look, we weren't buddies. We weren't friends. It was a professional relationship. They didn't hang out at Camp David together. They didn't socialize together. They didn't exchange birthday gifts. They didn't go hunting together. Whereas Condoleezza Rice was also a personal friend of the president. She had dinner at the residence with the president and first lady. She did go to Camp David for the weekends. She worked out with the president. They talked sports. Very different kind of relationship. So by the second term, when she becomes sort of the preeminent advisor, she's built on that relationship.
I got to say, I've been fascinated by watching what's happening in Wyoming, because Cheney did have a good personal relationship with Al Simpson until recently.
Yeah.
But that's a whole other story. Let me get some more of our callers on here. And Mary Ellen, join us. You're on. Hi, Mary Ellen.
Hi, good morning. My question is this, how much did the invasion of Iraq have to do with the PNAC doctrine?
Project for the New American Century.
Oh,
Bill Kristol.
Yeah.
The so-called neocons.
Well, certainly, yeah. There's no question that people inside the administration, like Paul Wolfowitz and Doug Feith and others, had long believed that the United States should be more assertive, more aggressive in terms of Iraq. If you look back at the 8 months before 9/11, Iraq was clearly number one on their national security list. They kind of overlooked bin Laden as who would turn out obviously to be the number one threat to America in that time. Having said that, at one point, Rumsfeld, who was involved with this project, sends a memo in July of 2001 saying they need to revamp and rethink what they're doing with Iraq. And he includes, among other options, a more military response. And there's no response. I mean, so, you know, I don't think that absent 9/11, they would have necessarily, gone to war. I think that 9/11 catalyzes an antipathy toward Iraq that was already there and then accelerates it into a far different sphere.
Let me thank the caller and go to an email from Robert, who says, politics aside, tough to do, does your guest feel there were real grounds for impeachment and possibly grounds for war crime trials?
Well, I'm certainly no lawyer. I couldn't say that. I think that, you know, there's never a serious effort at impeachment in the Congress.
Nancy Pelosi, I was at an evening after she decided not to go ahead with that, and there was a lot of anger directed toward, I mean, this is in San Francisco, mind
right,
you, but
right.
there was a lot of desire at that time to go ahead with impeachment.
Well, I think impeachment is a weapon, as they saw in the 90s with Clinton, that can politically backfire. And if it can be used against your president or the other president, it can be used against your president. I think after the Clinton experience, both sides have more or less, you know, sworn off impeachment as a serious tool at this point.
Bruce from Oakland wants to know, where did the missing White House emails go and will we ever see them again?
We're going to see a lot of emails, actually. What's interesting about this White House versus any other is that this is the first one in which email is a regular part of the conversation that took place inside. There was email in the Clinton White House, but not at the level that we use it today. And therefore, when the archives do open, which will be years to come, we're going to have a very different way of evaluating this White House than any previous one. We don't have tapes anymore like we did with JFK and Nixon and LBJ, but we will have the emails. It'll be interesting to read them.
And like I said, it's a little early to talk about legacies, but this one, even at this point, looks very mixed.
Right, well, of course, yeah. I mean, it's you can certainly put things on both sides of the ledger. President Bush argues that nobody will be able to judge him fairly until long after he's gone, and that may be the case. But I think we could at least begin to look at him, and there's lots of things in this book to evaluate.
There is a lot in the book indeed. It's called Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House. And Peter Baker, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Baker is Chief White House Correspondent for The New York Times, and he will be appearing at Commonwealth Club today at noon in San Francisco. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We have Richard Rodriguez joining us in the hour ahead. And forums produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from Chad McClymans. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, thank you for being a part of this morning's program. Stay tuned for another hour. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.